Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. Hour number two of the program. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Kyle Mabry is at the controls. We're also happy to have back in the studio with us once again, Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice doctor at Carl Clinic in Urbana. And every other month we do the show, we call it Talk to the Family Doctor. He's been good enough now for a long time to come by and to sit in the studio and take questions. It can be just about anything because he deals with people of all ages. He sees children. He sees grown-ups. He sees people with wide variety of health concerns. And we've built it into the schedule to make a regular opportunity for you to ask questions. Now, every time we have a doctor on the show, I always do the same thing. I said, do remember that there's only so much we can do over the telephone. But it's a good place to start. If you have some basic questions, you can call in and ask him, and I know he will do his best to give you an answer. And then you maybe need to take it from there with your own doctor or someone who can see you. But I don't want to discourage anybody from calling. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455 at any point. Go give us a call. Thanks very much for being here once again.
Thank you, David. I'm glad to be here, though after listening to the first part of your program, I was thinking that perhaps you needed a podiatrist for this hour to answer questions about big feet.
Oh, don't you deal with big feet and people who have problems with their feet? I know. You send them on to our good friend Dr. Bourne.
That's right. Right?
Okay. You know something I was thinking about? We're continuing to hear about apparently people who have been sick with the flu, with the H1N1 flu, the so-called swine flu. And, I'm thinking about the fact that we're used to thinking about flu as being something that you pretty much see, starting in the, late fall, early winter, and then it goes through to the spring and eventually starts to taper off. So it's kind of like a fall-winter thing. But that starts me thinking, well, is flu actually around? I mean, are there people who have influenza all through the year?
Yes, and in different parts of the world, the flu season can be at different times of the year. It's mm-hmm. just that in the climate that we have, it's typically the colder months. Yeah. But in fact, as you get closer and closer to the tropics, it's a much more year-round type possibility. So there's really no medical reason why you can't get the influenza in the summer.
Well, that's what I wondered, where even here, whether it was, it may not be not quite as common, but that in fact, yes, and that you could in the here in Champaign-Urbana in the summertime, it is possible to get flu.
Correct.
It is. Okay. So right at this point, what are people thinking about now with this, particularly with this flu? And, are you expecting that when we do get into the prime flu season that'll be coming, later on in the year, at this point, is there any thought that it might in fact be more serious than we've seen in maybe in the past couple of years?
I think it's a little early to predict that, but I think this is a good opportunity to remind people that getting a flu shot in the fall, before the major season starts, is still a very, very good idea. And the recommendations for who should get a flu shot basically keep getting expanded. So it really is not an unreasonable thing for just about everybody to think about getting a flu shot. The media certainly had a lot of attention placed on the fact that there were some fatal cases of swine flu, but I think people fail to truly grasp the fact that it's estimated that probably 30 to 35,000 people in the United States die every year from just the regular influenza. Right. And that can be significantly reduced if, in fact, people are adequately immunized. And so that number on a yearly basis is much, much higher than the number of people who've died from swine flu, though the media certainly has paid a lot of more attention to that.
Do I have it right in that at least some of the cases where people have gotten the H1N1 flu and have died, these were people that were otherwise not really not in good health. That is, they had maybe they had something else going on, some other condition that made it so that their body wasn't quite as good at fighting it off as it would have been if it's someone who was otherwise healthy.
Right, and that's true for many viral illnesses. You are going to find your highest mortality rates in those individuals who have either increased susceptibility to getting the infection or decreased ability to fight the infection. Mm-hmm. So if you look at the influenza mortality statistics, you see peaks at the very, very young end of the age spectrum and at the very, very end of the age spectrum. But you also see peaks in between, regardless of age, in individuals who have other underlying chronic medical illnesses that make them either more susceptible to the infection or simply they don't have the ability to fight off the infection as well.
Mm. Well, we have a caller here to start us off, someone in Champaign. This is line one.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I know that you do not diagnose, but I would like an opinion. I have an extended family member who I have a question about. She went into the hospital for pain evaluation with a herniated disc and ended up having a heart attack while in the hospital. And now the doctors want to give her first a medicinal stress test. And then if that shows any blockages, they want to do an angiogram. And I just, I questioned the person's husband as to the efficacy of having a medicinal stress test right on top of a heart attack. And I wondered if it was safer just to go ahead and do the angiogram. Do you have any thoughts on that? And I know you don't know the situation.
Right. We can make a couple general comments, I guess. The angiogram is the test by where contrast material or dye is put into the blood vessels. And in this particular case, you're putting dye into the blood vessels that feed the heart muscle itself, looking to see where the blockages are. This is an invasive test. You're poking into the vascular system
right.
with a catheter, and you're also injecting material that some people can either have a bad reaction to or be allergic to. And consequently, the angiogram itself, while a fairly commonly performed procedure, is not an entirely benign procedure. There is a certain amount of morbidity and mortality associated with doing the test. So, if you're going to say, well, gee, why don't I just get this test done? And somebody says, yeah, but you can die from that test.
Mm-hmm.
You really need to have a good reason to do so, or a very high index of suspicion that you're going to find something that you're going to be able to do something about. So in many instances, a non-invasive test is often done first to see if there is, in fact, enough indication to go ahead and do the more invasive test. Now, there's not enough information given what you've told me to say whether that is or isn't appropriate in this particular situation, but that's basically the mindset behind that.
Can you give a medicinal stress test to somebody who just had a heart attack?
You can. The question here is what additional information are they trying to find? In some instances, somebody has a, quote, relatively small heart attack, but there's a large amount of heart muscle that's still in danger because of potential blockage, and that will show up on the non-invasive testing. And that may indeed then indicate that they need to go ahead and do the angiogram. In many instances, if somebody had a heart attack and they basically killed off enough heart muscle that says, we can't do anything about that, going forward with an angiogram isn't going to change the outcome here. So it sounds like they're trying to determine whether there's enough residual good heart muscle left that they need to do something with.
One of the things they wanted to do after they found that she'd had a heart attack was to do a CAT scan, I presume, of the heart. And they wanted to inject dye for contrast, and she is very allergic to that dye.
Mm-hmm.
Would that be the same dye they would use in an angiogram?
Generally, those are quite similar, yes.
Uh-huh. So if she's allergic, she probably doesn't want that. Can you do an angiogram without the contrasting dye?
No.
Okay. Well, I thank you very much for the information.
You're welcome.
I will pass my thinking along to my friend.
All right. Well, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
You know, just I'm curious now, when someone says stress test, I'm thinking of the kind of thing where they take somebody and they stick some wires onto you and they put you on a treadmill,
mm-hmm.
and they say, okay, take a walk,
right.
and they measure your heart. There apparently is some way to do this that doesn't involve that kind of physical exertion?
Yes. There are individuals who just aren't physically capable of walking on a treadmill fast enough to elevate their heart rate. And in order to get a good stress test or useful, valid stress test, you need to raise somebody's heart rate a certain amount. It's sort of age-dependent as to how fast you have to get them to go. But basically, if somebody says, gee, I have like two bum knees, you know, I can't walk quickly on a treadmill, and you still want to check them out, there are chemicals that you can give them that will raise their heart rate. And it is a way of simulating what would happen if, in fact, they were walking.
Mm-hmm.
So there are ways to kind of get around situations where people can't walk on the treadmill.
All right. Next up, we'll talk with someone also in Champaign. This is line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I've been losing weight lately. I've been limiting my calories to 1,800 a day, and I also walk 8 miles a day. And in this heat, I tend to sweat a fair amount, and I'm just wondering if I'm getting enough salt. I was looking at the labels of what I eat, and it just doesn't look like, going by the sodium content, that I'm getting all that I need. And I was wondering, how would I know if I wasn't, and if that's something I need to worry about?
Usually it's not something you need to worry about if, in fact, you continue to eat and drink otherwise normally. There is, for better or worse, generally a fair amount of sodium in most of the things that we consume. So it's actually pretty unusual for somebody not to get enough sodium into their diet. Now, if you overdo the amount of water, just plain water that you drink, you can essentially dilute out the amount of sodium in your system. But in most instances, people aren't deficient in sodium. In fact, we frequently have to encourage people to consume less.
Right.
The standard cardiac diet is about 2 grams of sodium per day. So if you look on your labels and add that up, if you're in that ballpark, then you know you're fine.
Oh, okay. What if you weren't getting enough? Just out of curiosity, if you weren't getting enough salt, how would you know that? What would the effects be?
You really wouldn't know it unless your sodium level dropped extremely low.
Ah.
And
okay.
In which case, you would definitely feel very unwell.
Okay. Well, thanks for your help.
All right, thank you. Again, bye-bye. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Our guest is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice doctor from Carl Clinic in Urbana, and he's here on the program every other month. It's always on a Monday. We call it Talk to the Family Doctor because that's the idea. It is it's supposed to be pretty much wide open. And if you have a health care question, could be for yourself, could be for someone in your family, could be for a grown-up, could be for a child, whatever, you give us a call, and the doctor will do his best to help you out. We're now that we're getting into the summer, eventually we'll get into some really hot temperatures, and if people are exerting themselves, if they're working real hard outside, if they're playing sports, whatever, this one of the standard pieces of advice we always tell people, well, make sure that you stay well hydrated. Mm-hmm. So the best advice always is water. Drink water, just plain old water, that's right. Fine. Now, there are various kinds of products that are sold. Things like, maybe the very first commercial product probably was Gatorade, I guess. And then there are other things like that, that in addition to probably being mostly water, have other things in there.
Most of them have a little sugar for energy, mm-hmm. Some sodium, potassium chloride. Those are some of the electrolytes that are sometimes lost mm-hmm. through vigorous athletic participation and sweating. We often use those types of fluids for replacement when somebody has, say, persistent vomiting or diarrhea, because, again, they're losing not only water, but they're losing some of their electrolytes as well. So those are fine replacement fluids for individuals who are ill. But if people are, again, eating normally, they're going to get their sodium, they're going to get their potassium, and basically they just need to replace the water.
Yeah. So it's like you're saying that's real. I mean, if you want to have one of those things, that's okay.
It's
but
fine.
It's probably not really necessary.
Unless you're really at the extremes of right. your participation and not keeping up with your food and fluids as you otherwise should.
Mm. What would be some of the symptoms of heat stroke if someone was really seriously taxing their body at a time when it was really hot?
Well, the initial response is that people's heart rate will go up, and the blood vessels will all move closer to the surface of the skin, and basically the body is trying to radiate heat away from the core. The body will try to maintain its core temperature within a fairly narrow range. Obviously, too cold isn't good for you, but too hot isn't good for you either, in that certain tissues in the body will literally start to cook if the temperature is too high. And usually we're talking, over 107 degrees temperature. So you're mm-hmm. talking about something that's way up there. But people will basically be flushed because of their circulation coming closer to the surface of the skin. They'll be breathing much faster. And again, kind of like the dog panting. It's a way of cooling off. But those things also cause fluid loss because we're sweating when we're doing this. And so those need to be replaced. And much like the radiator in your car, if you don't have enough fluid in there, at some point it's going to boil over. And so you need to constantly replace those fluids in order to prevent that. But then people will start to feel dizzy, lightheaded, nauseous, weak. And at some point they may, in fact, collapse. When the body totally loses its ability to compensate, then it'll simply go into shock. And now we have a major medical emergency. But short of that, most individuals, if they can get out of the heat, lay down someplace cool, get their fluids on board, and rest, will usually recover pretty well.
Yeah. Is it, I know that I have heard of this, and I don't know how much water you would actually have to drink for such a thing to be possible, but is it actually possible to drink too much water?
Yes, it is. As we referred to the previous gentleman, if you dilute out your electrolytes, if you basically make the solutions within the body so dilute that the concentration of your sodium and your potassium and your chloride drop precipitously, then many of our internal systems don't function normally. And in fact, a sodium level, which is normally somewhere around 135 to 145, if it drops under 120, people are going to start feeling bad. And a sodium under 100 can, in fact, be fatal. there are all sorts of bad things that then start to get out of whack. And we have, in fact, seen folks who've done that. In some instances, alcohol will do that. But there have been reported cases of people who've simply had too much water to drink too fast and diluted it out and basically caused some major medical problems.
Yeah. So, I don't know how much that would take, but it sounds as if—
It would depend on the size of the person.
So, but probably if you're really going to— if you're going to be working outside and it's hot or you're going to be playing sports, that it's probably good rather than, you know, going a long period of time and just drinking as much as you can hold. Try to, as you're going along, sort of maintain a sort of a reasonable and steady kind of
right, much intake. Like the when you watch the marathon runners, they don't run 26 miles and then, you know,
have a drink
the entire Gatorade container. They, as they go along, you know, take a glass or two, and you know, half of it goes in and the other half goes on top of their head to cool off. But they're doing that constantly as they go along, and that's the appropriate way to do it.
We're already close to the midpoint here. Dr. Jeff Swearingen is our guest. He's a family practice physician from Carl Clinic in Urbana. This is our Talk to the Family Doctor show. We do it every other month, and if you have healthcare questions, call us 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Here's a caller in Champaign. This is our line 4. Hello.
Yeah, hi, David. Thanks for taking my call. I joined the conversation a little bit late, so please forgive me. But I had actually a quick question for the doctor. I have a 13-year-old daughter who about 5 years ago developed something called a pyloric spasm, which was in her gut. Basically, we took care of that through muscle relaxants. So fast forward now, she's 13, and she's developed something that's very rare. It's called strabismus, and it's a defect in her eye, and we have to take her in for outpatient medical surgeries to correct a muscle in her eye. But the thing that really floored us when we took her to the hospital was the doctor said this strabismus has been known to happen to people who have gastrointestinal problems. Well, there you go. You know, I would have never correlated the two together. I mean, your muscle and your gut and then affecting your eye, but I just thought that was fascinating that the doctor nailed it. And I was just wondering if you had any experience with that or if you ever heard of it before. And I'll go ahead and listen off the air. Thank you.
Okay. It's a very interesting observation. I personally am not aware of that. I can't say I recall any patients of mine with that combination. It may go back to the development of the embryo. If there was something at a particular point in development that altered muscle development, it's possible that it occurred in more than one area at the same time. But as I said, I'm not personally aware of any association there, but we know that people who are born with certain conditions can have other conditions at the same time because something happened during development that basically affected more than one system at the same time.
Okay. Well, again, I hope that gets the question of the caller. Let's go on and talk with some other folks here. We have a couple of people in Champaign, and we'll go first to line 1 right here. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
This is a follow-up question to the earlier discussion of sodium intake. I'm trying to reduce my own sodium intake, and I came across a product called No Salt, and I wondered what you thought of this. It looks like it has lots of chemical ingredients, potassium chloride and so forth, but no sodium.
Right. Many of these salt substitutes basically put potassium in instead of sodium.
So is that safe, or are we simply backing into a different problem?
No, the only time that it wouldn't be safe as such is if somebody has some other medical condition where they need to avoid excess potassium. Some patients who have significant kidney disease have to be careful about their potassium levels. But for the average person who doesn't have that kind of problem, who's just simply trying to cut back on their sodium, the use of a potassium salt substitute is usually very reasonable.
Okay, thanks very much.
All right, thank you. But is that the kind of thing, though, that before you were doing that, you would use that, you might want to have a chat with your doctor about that, or would you not worry about that?
If you had other underlying medical conditions, it's certainly a reasonable thing to ask about. If you're otherwise generally healthy, not on any particular medications, not having any underlying kidney disease, and you simply say, gee, I'm going to cut back on my salt, using that would be fine. The other thing that many people will use instead is, and I don't want to plug a particular product, but it's called Mrs. Dash, and it's basically just a combination of sort of herbs and spices to flavor food that instead of using salt.
Yeah.
So there are even some things that don't even have a lot of potassium in them if you want to use them to flavor food.
So on average, how much do we have a number, say, for the average American, how much sodium we think they're taking in?
Oh my!
And how much more than
if you don't look at the label on anything and you just eat the average American diet, you probably consume somewhere between 10 and 20 times the amount of sodium that your body actually needs on a daily basis.
And
so most people who say, "Well, gee, I'm just going to cut back," are still taking in, you know, plenty of sodium. So as we alluded to previously, it would be pretty tough to become sodium deficient as a result of cutting back on your diet.
Yeah. All right, let's go to Champagne. Line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have low sodium, and I have had for years. Every time my blood is tested, it comes back low, and no doctor ever seemed concerned about it until a few years ago, and she told me to cut down on liquids, but I did that. I have just a normal diet. So a pharmacist told me to take Oralite, and that seems to help, but nobody seems to know how much I should take. I usually take between a half a cup and a cup every day.
Are you on any medications that would lower your sodium level?
I don't know. Blood pressure medicine.
Very commonly, certain types of blood pressure medication are, in fact, associated with lower levels of sodium and sometimes potassium as well.
Oh. Okay.
And from a medical standpoint, that's probably the most common thing that we see, is that somebody on especially what we call the water pill type of blood pressure medications.
Yeah, I'm not on that. I'm on Diovan.
And is it combined with hydrochlorothiazide?
No.
You take any other type of, Lasix or furosemide?
I'm taking sertraline. Would that do it?
Usually not. But a number of the blood pressure medications can. And in those particular settings, it simply depends on how low the sodium goes. If you're simply a few points below the average range, that's not going to cause you any harm. And if it's stable, probably nothing needs to be done about it.
Before the Oralite, it dropped quite low, and I just felt awful.
Mm-hmm.
Felt terrible.
Well, you also mentioned that you were asked to sort of cut back on the amount of water you were taking in, and that goes back to our previous comment, in that some individuals, if they take in a little too much water, end up diluting the amount of sodium in their system, so it measures lower.
Yeah. Well, should I know everybody's supposed to cut back on salt. Should I also do that, or can I use as much salt as I want?
Well, that one I'm going to have to defer to your regular doctor, not knowing the rest of your medical situation.
Right. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you. And again, other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. There is apparently this relationship between your sodium intake and blood pressure.
Correct.
High sodium, high blood pressure.
Correct. And most individuals who have relatively high sodium intake, if they are conscientious about cutting back, you know, to a reasonable range can, in fact, see anywhere from a 5 to 10% drop in their blood pressure.
Yeah. Are there other things that are problematic about high sodium intake? I mean, that probably is bad enough because, you know, the high blood pressure is related to potential for heart disease and stroke. And so you don't want to do that.
The other common complaint that we get from folks who basically have excess sodium is sodium will cause your body to retain more fluid. And those folks frequently complain, gee, my feet are swollen, my ankles are puffy. Mm-hmm. And in fact, when you cut them back on their sodium, they're often surprised to find out that, gee, and I lost weight too, because most of that was just excess fluid being retained by the excess sodium.
Yeah. One thing I thought maybe we might talk a little bit about, we started out here, I said I was thinking I was maybe experiencing some allergy symptoms myself. We're now coming into, well, you said actually there were maybe like three times of the year when people and you know, maybe different people have symptoms different times.
The early spring, as the trees start to flower, is a fairly typical time for people to have the onset of seasonal allergies. And we're talking about the runny nose and the sneezing and the itchy, watery eyes and the postnasal drip. And for susceptible individuals, sometimes their allergies will kick off their asthma. So then we run into folks who have, you know, trouble with their breathing, their coughing and wheezing as well. So as we get into summer, a lot of the grasses are in sort of full bloom. And again, individuals who are sensitive to that will have a particular time of year where they're having more trouble. In the late summer, usually kind of mid-August until the first frost, we have the more traditional hay fever season. And then a lot of people's allergies quiet down once all of the plant material sort of goes away in the winter. Now, there are folks who have indoor allergies. They have the dust, the mold, those sorts of things. And when you turn on the heat, especially if you have forced air heating in the house, those folks will sometimes have more of a problem.
Yeah.
But a lot of people with the outdoor seasonal allergies will do much better in the winter once the plants are gone.
For that, you know, maybe you can do what you can to spend your time inside in air-conditioned spaces where maybe there's some air filtration. But if you're going to be outside, there's not a lot that you can do. There are some variety of things that are available both over-the-counter and by prescription to try to help with symptoms. From your experience, what things, maybe starting with something that anybody could just go out and buy, what things seem to help?
Well, typically a lot of the allergy symptoms are generated when the body releases histamine. So the common over-the-counter treatment is to take an antihistamine, and they basically fall into a couple of categories. There are the non-sedating antihistamines, and this is your Claritin and Zyrtec type medications. Those are available over the counter, and they're available generically, and so they're relatively inexpensive. They're usually very well tolerated because they're not sedating, and many people will do just fine with that. The sort of heavier or bigger gun antihistamine is things like Benadryl, and the chemical name there is diphenhydramine, and if you look at a lot of the over-the-counter allergy combination medications, you'll see diphenhydramine as one of the major ingredients. It's an excellent antihistamine, but tends to be somewhat sedating. If you look in a lot of the sleep aids, you'll find that it's one of the active ingredients as well because of that sedative side effect. So we often tell people that if you're going to use that, you might want to use it in the evening, if it's going to make you sleepy. So separate from the antihistamine type medications, there are some over-the-counter nasal sprays, there are over-the-counter eye drops, things that people can try to minimize symptoms. And then there are also prescription medications. Most of those fall into the what we call nasal steroid category, the Beconase, Flonase, Nasacort type medications. And these are often used in conjunction with the oral antihistamines and work very, very well. They basically help block the allergic response, but they only work where they're sprayed. So basically, you have to get it into your nose and your sinuses to really be helpful. And they do have the advantage, though, of not being sedating. They basically work locally, so there's not a lot of systemic absorption. So that combination, for a number of people, works very well. There's some prescription eye drops for bad allergies as well. If somebody says, you know, I'm trying to stay away from the things I'm allergic to, I'm taking my antihistamine, I'm using my nasal steroid, I'm using my eye drops, and I'm still miserable, especially if it's triggering bad asthma, at that point, a visit to the allergist is probably the next step. And not so much to figure out what you're allergic to, because most people generally know what it is they're allergic to. At that point, you're looking at producing an allergy extract so that you can get allergy shots, with the idea that over a long period of time, usually several years, you can build up what are called blocking antibodies so that you become less sensitive to the things that trigger your allergic response.
Yeah.
But that's a long-term approach to treating allergies that for some individuals can be very, very helpful, but is definitely much more involved than simply going down to the pharmacy and picking up something over the counter.
Yeah. And for the inhaled steroid medicines, are those things that are only available by prescription?
Correct.
All right. And there, again, for anybody who was, you know, hears steroid and thinks, oh, that's bad. The
right.
good thing about these
you
things
is that... You won't get into
that,
the Hall of Fame.
You won't, yeah. It's, you don't get the whole body
no.
effect, because it only pretty much goes where you spray. Put it.
Exactly.
So, okay.
Yeah. And that's the major advantage, because a lot of the steroid medications in oral or systemic form have a whole host of potential side effects if you take enough of it long enough. And that type of situation can, in fact, usually be avoided by using what we call the topical nasal steroids, just the inhaled ones that basically work on the surface of the nose and the sinuses. And there's very, very little systemic absorption.
Yeah. We certainly, as you say, we've heard stories about steroid
right.
abuse.
And those are different kinds of steroids.
Those are different kinds of steroids. But I guess there are certain times when steroids are very therapeutically, they're mm-hmm. they're very, very useful.
Oh, yes.
They're a
powerful
good thing.
Powerful anti-inflammatory medication.
Has anybody worked on trying to do something about getting the benefit and yet and somehow doing something about the side effects, or is it you're going to have the other one?
It seems to be part and parcel of the entity itself. We know that steroid medications can be very, very useful in many inflammatory type conditions, but we also realize that when we use the bigger doses as soon as possible, we need to start cutting back. So many people who are put on oral steroids or systemic steroids for a period of time are then, as fast as possible, tapered off of. But in the meantime, those folks need to be monitored very closely. In terms of side effects, their blood pressure can go up. If they're diabetic, their blood sugars can go up. Individuals who are susceptible to ulcer disease are going to have a problem here. It can lead to significant edema and weight gain. There are a few people who literally become sort of crazy when they take steroids. Mm-hmm. So there are some very significant potential side effects to basically larger doses, especially if they're continued for a period of time. So when used, and we do use them frequently, it's usually for a very short period of time with a fairly rapid taper from a big dose back down to a small dose to try and avoid those side effects.
About 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. It's the show that we call Talk to the Family Doctor. We do every other month on a Monday with Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice physician from Carl Clinic in Urbana. It's an opportunity to ask general kinds of healthcare questions. So if something is on your mind for yourself or someone in your family, you can call us. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. And we do also have a toll-free free line. That means that if it would be a long-distance call for you, we'll pay for the call. That's 800-222-9455. Again, 333-WILL. That probably doesn't make it any easier to remember. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Something that we continue to hear about, and we've talked about this, and I expect when I've had pediatricians on the program, we've talked about that, is diabetes, and particularly the increase in type 1 diabetes among let me get this straight. I'm thinking of the increase in what we used to call adult onset, which I think that's type 2. Yeah, very good. I'll scratch that one out on my exam and say, no, what I really meant was type 2. The increase in that kind of diabetes that we didn't really used to see in children.
Right.
Reason we have a significant concern about this because, you know, it can lead to lifelong health problems, and that it's, I think a lot of people would argue, though, this is a really preventable thing. There's really no reason why children or adolescents should be developing these things. Is this something we're still seeing?
Yes,
more and more?
And to a large extent, that's a function of weight, in that unfortunately, children eat more and exercise less, and consequently are, in general, much heavier than generations earlier. And what we know physiologically is that within the body, fat cells are relatively resistant to the effects of insulin. So these folks, both kids and adults, aren't necessarily deficient in insulin. In fact, they have plenty. It's just that it's not very effective in terms of getting the sugar out of the bloodstream back into the cells of the body where it sort of belongs. And as weight goes down, the insulin then becomes more effective. The blood sugars are much better controlled, and a lot of the complications of long-term diabetes then can be avoided. But a lot of it basically just goes back to, you know, eat less, exercise more, get your weight down. The gentleman had called earlier who had cut back to 1,800 calories and was walking 8 miles a day was doing the right things in terms of minimizing his chances for problems of all sorts, diabetes included, high blood pressure, cardiovascular disease. And we basically need to cut back on a lot of the snacks that kids eat, and they need to get outdoors and, you know, stop texting on their phone or stop playing their video games and do something physical. Yeah. Unfortunately, you know, there's not even a lot of PE anymore in school. So that's I think, an end result of the sort of lifestyle that Americans, unfortunately, have adopted.
Do you now, at some point with kids, are you starting to do more as a routine kind of screening thing to do blood sugar?
Not necessarily blood sugar, unless there's an indication for testing. But one of the things that is fairly standard now as kids come in is to look at their height and their weight, calculate their BMI, their body mass index, and there are set sort of numbers of what's healthy and what's not. And there is a lot more emphasis on saying, you know, yeah, maybe he'll outgrow it later, but let's start looking at what's going on right now. Most physicians do not recommend that children lose weight, except in, you know, extraordinary circumstances. But in many instances, if a child's weight can remain stable while he or she gets taller, that balance between their height and weight and their BMI will, in fact, improve. Yeah. So most kids don't need to be dieting, but, you know, if you consider dieting just cutting out the crap, then they should be dieting. But, you know, there's just way too many extra calories floating around that kids and, for that matter, adults don't
need. The answer is get physical activity and get a healthy diet.
Mm-hmm.
I was really, and it was not very long ago, I was talking with somebody who had written a book about the issue of weight. One of the things I thought was really interesting was he talked about how over time the what people, the kind of fluids that people were taking in had really changed, and that part of the problem now is that a lot of our fluid intake is some kind of, it's not water.
Right.
It's some kind of high calorie beverage.
Right.
So it's either it's lattes or it's soda or something like that.
Even fruit juice, you know, people think, oh, well, you know, it's fruit. Isn't that healthy? Well, most fruit juice contains just a boatload of sugar in one form or another. Yeah. And so in essence, no, it's not the ideal choice for kids.
Okay. Well, we have several callers here. We'll see when we get them in. The time that's left, we'll start with line one in Champaign. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I have almost an opposite question to what you were just talking about. I have a 16-month-old who is quite low in the percentile of both height and weight. She's under the 5th percentile for height and between the 5th and 10th for weight, even though at birth she was about average. And, you know, her pediatrician at each appointment kind of keeps encouraging me to try to get more high calorie density into her diet, and we try to do that. But I was just wondering if there are any other issues that maybe we should be looking at as possible concerns for being, you know, for dropping in the percentiles like that.
Has this been sort of a slow, steady decline, or was she sort of average for a while and then just suddenly bottomed out?
She was probably average until about 4 to 6 months, and then really since then she's just been very slow to gain much weight at all. I think at 6 months she was 15 and a half pounds, and then at 15 months she was 20 pounds.
And
only gained an inch and a half in that time.
And has there been any developmental delay associated with the slow growth?
No, developmentally, really, in all areas, she's on track.
Okay. Which in itself is very reassuring. Many of the medical conditions that we worry about that are associated with either slow growth are often then associated with other developmental delays. So the fact that she's otherwise hitting her regular milestones for development is quite reassuring. The initial birth weight in the first couple of months is usually a reflection of what your nutrition was like during pregnancy.
Okay.
And after that, the genetic factors that she has inherited will come into play. So within your family or your husband's family, are there particularly small people? Are we talking big people?
Well,
is she out of
either average to a little below average? Like I'm 5'6", my husband is 5'10". So I wouldn't say that we're, you know, particularly small.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure. I mean, you know, like I had read that you're half of your adult height when you reach 2, and at the target she's on, I think she'd be, you know, less than 5 feet.
Yeah. Well,
and there's no one in either of our families that
who's unusually
that size.
Small. Okay.
Yeah.
The key, I think, is going to be to see if she's otherwise active, healthy, eating, and developing normally, as with any sort of bell-shaped curve like we have with height and weight. You know, most people are somewhere in the middle, but there are folks obviously at either end. The key here is to simply be able to, via your own doctor, make sure that there aren't any other medical conditions impeding growth, but the majority of those that do also impede pair development. So it's actually sounding pretty reassuring that she's coming along normally in that regard.
Okay. Great. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. We'll try to get one more caller here. Urbana, line two. Go ahead.
Yeah, this is a question where when I'm sleeping, I get cramps in my legs. They don't come on suddenly. It usually happens toward the morning when I turn over from my back or to the side, then there's in stretching there seem to occur these cramps. And I'm just curious what you know about this sort of phenomenon, syndrome.
It's actually fairly common, not necessarily pathological. The muscles need to be regularly stretched to prevent them from tightening. And in many instances, we have people do some foot and calf stretching exercises before they go to bed, or sometimes even in bed when they wake up. But generally speaking, in and of itself, if this is not the thing that's waking you up, isn't anything that you need to worry about.
I see. I just thought I was curious. When I was younger, it didn't happen, of course.
There were lots of things that didn't happen when you were younger.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thank you for the call. We are just about at the point we have to finish up. I don't know, is there anything you might like to leave with people in general? Yeah. Other than do the stuff that your mom said that you should do.
Say, mom was right. You know, eat your vegetables, go outside and play.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of the medical problems that we see chronically in the office are lifestyle related. Now, obviously, people inherit certain tendencies and problems, and there are things that just happen that we don't have a good explanation for, but there is just a ton of the garden variety problems that we see in terms of blood pressure and blood sugar and subsequently heart disease that are related to, you know, how well people take care of themselves on a daily basis. And, you know, tobacco, alcohol, excess calories, not enough exercise, you know, driving drunk and not wearing your seatbelt. I mean, there's a whole host of just sort of basic common sense things that at least we think are common sense, that people need to remember to do on a daily basis.
All right. Well, there we'll leave it. Dr. Jeff will be back again next month, month after next.
Correct.
So that would be August?
August,
yeah,
it is.
Yeah, okay. Thank you very much. Dr. Jeff Swearingen, he's family practice physician at Carl Clinic in Urbana, and he's with us every other month for the show we call Talk to the Family Doctor.